All right. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chris Taylor from the New York Stock Exchange. I'll be moderating, more like timekeeping, the last panel of the day. I know we're going to hit cocktails on our commute home, so we'll make sure that we get out of here on time. We've got seven folks from the analyst community on the panel. I know everyone will have a lot to say, so I think I'm going to get away with one question, and I want each of the esteemed panelists to give their opinions on, you know, as we wrap up today, your keenest observations, whether it's geopolitical, regulatory, macroeconomic, the biggest risks, biggest opportunities that you see following the day's events. So, Christian, you are in the leadoff position, so I'll turn it over to you, and you are on the clock.
Fantastic, thanks. And I don't know if I can even fill that much time, but I'll do my best. So, you know, I think from our perspective, I'm at Citi. I cover all of transportation as well as shipping. So I have, you know, I think there might be another analyst or two who has that type of perspective. But from my standpoint, you know, I'm going to go back to what my colleague Tobias this morning sort of started with, which was a relatively sort of bullish outlook about sort of the global macro view, and particularly here, you know, what's going on in the domestic United States. So when I look at things like rail car loadings or truck activity, I see, you know, business activity picking up. And I saw that happen in the third quarter of last year. I've seen that continue through the fourth quarter into the first quarter. And that all happened, started at least, before the election. So I think from a fundamental standpoint, we're, I think, constructive on, you know, the pace of economic growth, the fact that it is accelerating a little bit. And, you know, generally speaking, my view is I think that there's risk to the upside from a demand perspective. So demand for all types of goods, that's the commodities that shipping markets cover. It's also, you know, consumer-focused goods that are coming in on container ships and being moved around on trucks. And so, you know, with that backdrop, we're pretty, you know, pretty bullish in equities in general at Citi. And then within transportation and shipping, we're also reasonably constructive. Probably a little bit more bullish on my core transportation coverage than I am on some of the shipping markets, but certainly, you know, still positive overall. You know, when I think about shipping, I guess the way that I sort of look at it, I've been doing this for about 12 years and covering the space, we've seen sort of the cycles up and down. You know, maybe we're a little bit more cautious with the way that we want to get our exposure in this sector. But, you know, from my perspective, I think there are some higher quality companies now than we've seen for a while. There's some interesting end markets that I think do have some consistency of cash flow, and that's what we look for, you know, within our shipping coverage because of the volatility. I mean, let's face it, you have to be extremely nimble and extremely, you know, sort of quick with the way you think about the stocks getting in and out in order to really play the cycles well. And so we like to think about sort of longevity. So with that sort of as the backdrop, I think there's, you know, a couple of yield plays that we still think are very interesting. You know, we think Gaslog Partners, Andy was just up on the panel here. I like that stock. I think that's an interesting one. Getting paid 9% to own the stock, I think there's going to be upside. We have a nice pipeline of vehicles being dropped down into the MLP over the course of the next several years. So I'm okay earning 9% and getting some upside from further dropdowns. We recently upgraded Gaslog, the parent company, to a buy, giving these guys a little credit in the front row here. But I think, you know, that's also an interesting one just because of the fact that the MLP is doing well. You know, I think when you look at this, if you can get the MLP cycles opening up and really get that recycling of cash from the LP back to the GP, you can do a really nice job delevering at the GP, being able to invest in some other interesting opportunities that we expect down the road from them. And ultimately, as an equity holder, I'm going to come out sort of well in front. And I think it's a relatively high quality management team that has a good vision of what they want to do in a good market. So that's kind of the way that we're thinking about it. You know, I think the other area where we think you can be a little bit, if you can take a slightly longer term view, another area where we're beginning to see some deeper value is also on the tanker side. So I think that's, you know, I think that I'll take it. I think that's, you know, there is some value on the tanker side too. So, you know, from my perspective, we have a buy on Euronav. You know, Patty's an interesting guy and he has a lot of interesting opinions. And I think he's doing the right thing in terms of positioning the company for the next sort of turn in the cycle. We're at a tough market right now. The asset prices are down 30%. The equity values are down a lot more than that over the course of the last 2 years. I think if you can look at another 2 years, I think these are really interesting times, and we could see these stocks double from here. So I think that's the way we're doing it. That's the way within my coverage universe, which I have to be very careful to talk only about my coverage universe, if there's anybody from compliance listening. That's kind of the way that we're thinking about. So those are a couple of names I just wanted to throw out there. I'm not there yet on the dry bulk side. It was a very bullish panel this morning. I thought it was very interesting. I'm not ready to kind of pull the trigger there yet. And it sounds like, although I don't cover any of his companies, I probably should buy anything that Robert Bugbee owns. So other than that, that's kind of the way we're thinking about it. I'll pass that over to Herman. I think I hit my time pretty good.
You were perfect, actually. So Herman, if you want to introduce yourself real quickly and go from there.
Herman Hilden from Clarkson Platzo. Well done, Chris. I think as a general theme in shipping today, we have a supply side which is completely choked. I mentioned this statistics a few times at previous panels, but it's worth reminding everyone. The number of yards that received new orders peaked in 2007 at just below 200 yards. Last year, 27 yards received one new order. Out of those 27 yards, only 7 received more than 5. The setup on the supply side is very good. And then if you look on the demand side, I think one common factor that we all rely on as an external input factor to our demand side equation is global growth. If you look on IMF and their projections on global growth the last 6 years since 2011, it's been next year it's going to be better, and then they revise down their demand or GDP estimates throughout the year for 6 years in a row. I think over the last 6 months, there is something fundamentally changing amongst investors. Feels that investors are generally much more bullish about economic growth. I think what's happened since 2011 until last year was a decline in commodity price environment, which has been negative for emerging markets and for commodity exporting countries. Last year, that turned a corner. We've seen higher commodity prices supporting emerging markets and so on. I think that's driving the bullishness on call it global GDP growth. And then when you kind of boil that down to shipping, and I've said this a few years back, but to explain how it feels looking at the shipping space today, whether it being the tankers, the dry bulks, the LNG, and try to pick one of them, you know, it's like trying to choose a girl in the Victoria's Secret shows.
Jesus.
You know, there's a... attractive blonde people in the dry bulk space. Dry bulk, because of its price, is so incredibly attractive. Because of the order book, is so incredibly attractive. And the question we get frequently is, okay, some equities on the dry side have rallied 300% and more over the last 12 months. If you take a 10-year-old Cape, it's moved from $12 to $20 million. That's a 67% move over the last 12 months. If you had 80% leverage last year, which... I think you did pretty well if you had that low leverage last year because everyone was really struggling. Then mathematically, your equity should be up 300%+. And when you look at where we are now on the 10-year-old Cape, just by going back to the construction cost of a Cape and to parity on second-hand prices, it should still move from $20 to $28 million. We're still way below where we were in 2014 at $38 million for a 10-year-old Cape. And just miles away from where we were in 2018 at 116. So I think shipping today is investing, buying companies that have a solid balance sheet, low cash break even, and even in the tanker space, if you take DHT and Euronav, I agree with you. Euronav is a very, very solid, good company. They need just above $20,000 a day to build NAV from operation. That means if you take the current asset prices, how much do they need to generate to compensate for the fact that the fleet gets older? What are they paying in interest and G&A and OPEX? They need more, just above $20,000 a day. So at the low point, call it, in 2017, solid companies like DHT, like Euronav, and so on, will actually build value from operations. Moving on to the LNG space, I also see the Gasol guys on the first row. And I agree with you. The fact that the MLP space has opened up has created a lot of very interesting, call it, opportunities. If you use GLOP as a proxy for how GLOG should be trading, it should be at $20 and not $15. So, yeah, I mean, there's a pretty good selection of attractive opportunities.
Thanks, Herman. Appreciate it. Doug?
Yep, certainly. Yeah, and not to be overly repetitive from what Chris and Herman went over with the global backdrop, economic growth is getting better. I mean, we're seeing it in a variety of ways as it pertains to some of the commodities that a lot of the shipping companies transport. You're seeing it showing up in commodity prices. So, you know, when you're in the business of moving those commodities, or when you look a bit further upstream, whenever you're in the business of producing some of those commodities, those guys are going to be incentivized to start producing more and then inevitably start shipping more. So not saying that we're going back to a pre-08 type of a world, but we're certainly seemingly in a better world going forward than we've been in from 2009 through 2016. And that should have a very positive impact on a lot of the shipping businesses. You know, keeping it within the global shipping market and our coverage universe, you know, we cover companies in six distinct sectors. You know, the first and our favorite is the LNG shipping market. We upgraded the space last April, so about 11 months ago, and we continue to like that sector as having the most attractive outlook. You certainly have a cooperative economic backdrop that is supportive of commodity prices, including crude, so then therefore LNG becomes more competitive as an energy source. And when you couple that economic backdrop with the fact that you're adding a new liquefaction production train basically every other month for the next 3 to 4 years, you're going to have a very nice structural story behind the demand for those types of ships. And another thing that we like about LNG shipping is not just, you know, on the demand side, but, you know, inevitably, when you look at the shipping cycles and you overbuild, one of the topics that came up on the product tanker panel was how shipbuilding capacity is shrinking. You know, that is a very rare, not, you know, that rarely happens. And so the fact that it is very encouraging for that particular market, which I'll get to in a second. But, you know, when you look at LNG shipping, you've only got 9 shipyards in the world that can build an LNG carrier. And so your restriction isn't just capital availability, it is shipbuilding capacity. And so to us, that makes LNG shipping a bit different than some of the other shipping markets. But you know, because we've seen some positive momentum in chartering activity and utilization levels and earnings, and now you're getting back even in the spot market to nearly being cash break even, we think there's a lot of runway in that particular market. After that, you know, our second favorite is the product tanker market, which I was the moderator of the panel a little bit ago. And everything that was discussed in that panel is consistent with our views. You know, we do think in the near term you have to work off an inventory overhang that was created by overproducing in 2014 and 15. And so when you were, you know, adding refining capacity of 2 million barrels a day and your global oil demands aren't growing at 1, yeah, you're going to overproduce. And you probably borrowed a little bit of 16 strength and saw it in 14 and 15. But your end-user demand is still good. It's 1.5 million barrels a day and growing. You're still adding at least 1 million barrels a day for the next couple of years in export refining capacity. You could be shutting down some as crude prices increase and you know, the margins for some of the less competitive refineries aren't as attractive. You could be seeing some of those guys in the end-user markets closing down, and you could start seeing, you know, more refined products being shipped in an environment where fleet growth next year is going to be 1%. So, you know, we like that setup. We don't know if it's going to be next week, next month, but we certainly think it'll be at some point this year that you see an inflection point in the refined product tanker market. After that, you know, the previous panel, we actually like the setup for the LPG market as well, but also kind of a second half 17, 2018 market where fleet growth in that market is going to be, you know, sub 2% overall. So, you know, a little bit of work to do in the near term, but, you know, the setup whenever your fleet isn't growing and economic growth is pretty good. And I would say after, you know, those first three segments, LNG products and LPG, the crude market certainly starts to get attractive. Now, fleet growth is a little bit more there in the second half of this year in 18 than products and LPG, but, you know, it's still, we think, manageable in a world where, once again, oil demand growth is strengthening. And so if OPEC gets successful in working off their inventories in the next few months, and you've got global oil demand last year 1.5 and maybe growing this year above that, then they're going to have to play some catch-up, and that could be very good for the oil tankers. After that, dry cargo in the next 20 seconds. You know, Most of our ratings in dry have been buys, but because we thought the stocks were just so darn cheap, there's more of a value play as opposed to having a lot of conviction on the demand side. Certainly, everyone knows there's no new ships coming or very few new ships coming. You could actually have negative fleet growth next year. It's just, you know, it's very, very difficult to predict the demand side of the equation. Certainly with China, you know, trying to rationalize iron ore production capacity, coal production capacity, looking to upgrade what they're using for raw materials, that bodes very, very well for the BHPs, Rio Tintos and Valleys of the world. And by, you know, by de facto, it will bode well for the dry bulk guys. So the situation there is certainly set up, but you know, you just don't have the same visibility as you do in LNG, where you see the production trains when they're coming online, the shipping requirements, and some of the same export refineries coming online. So that's kind of how we view those five particular markets. We left containers out because with protectionism and all, it's just too difficult of a market for us to call. But that's what we think about some of the bigger the five markets that we cover.
So, thanks, Doug. James, how about you?
All right, so we're particularly bullish on the tanker sector for a number of reasons. One is it's not just the exports out of the U.S. Gulf, but the overall dislocation of crude cargoes throughout the world. It's true that U.S. capacity is growing, U.S. production is growing. The rig count went up again last week. But what's important to note there is, instead of the Permian Basin, the growth there was from the non-Permian, non-Eagle Ford plays, the Williston and the Mississippi, which has a higher break-even. So what this tells us is oil at around 50 to 55 is sustainable for the U.S. And so that extra U.S. production is going to be exported. The WTI FOB prices are competitive with Azeria and Urals over in Europe. The cracking yields are outperforming the North Sea 40s and the Arab Lights. So that makes it, you know, so we believe additional U.S. exports are going to happen. Another thing is the heavy crudes. So there's been a number of non-traditional U.S. Heavy sour crudes being exported to long-haul trades. South Korea took a couple. Japan took a couple. There's a couple going to Singapore. And we think this might normalize in probably 17 and 18. And we also see additional exports coming out of the East Coast of Canada. There's about 3 million barrels that's already been contracted. I think with the rail infrastructure over in Canada, with the congestion due to the Western Canadian Select and the bitumen tying up the railroads going west and south, you're going to see more exports going out of Montreal and possibly out of Newfoundland. And that route is about 11,500 nautical miles, which is two and a half times from the Arabian Gulf to the Far East. So for all these factors, we think the cruise sector is going to do well. Ton-mile demand is great. It helps to absorb any excess supply. And to piggyback off what Patty was saying with the shipyard constraints, if you look at the political climate in South Korea right now, they impeached their former president, who's conservative, who's pro-conglomerate. Right? The Koreans, they just jailed the head of Samsung. And the sentiment in South Korea is to not bail out these family-owned conglomerates. And so what you see there is you have the National Pension Service of Korea and KDB, which own a majority of the shipyards. We don't think that they're going to continue to bail out these shipyards, and the shipyards will have to be selective in what projects they take on. And therefore, we don't think the cruise sector is going to take a huge hit in terms of capacity growth. We think the LNG sector is probably going to get a lot more orders. And what else is there? Yeah, sorry, that's all I have. Thanks.
Thanks, James. So, Ben, if you had $100 million show up on your
right. Office, does, now we're talking.
Ben does have $100 million. What are you talking about?
Go ahead.
If I had $100 million, I would Give not be sitting here, I tell you that. Nicholas, I would. Don't worry. I got to say, if I'm just picking one, I do think that the tanker market just generally, I think the broader industry dynamics and the broader market could continue to do really well, but it feels a little fragile. And if I'm putting money to work today, I want to kind of do it in a way that limits my downside risk. I think you probably could do that with some of the MLPs. I think also the tanker market in general is set up to be pretty asymmetric. I mean, evaluations aren't expensive by almost any measure, and the market's not anticipating a whole lot going right. So, yeah, there's only flat or better. So that's probably where I'd start to spend, you know, at least $10 or $20 and find something else to do with the balance, I think. But with that, I'll let Amit go so that he can finish playing with the game he's playing on the phone.
All right, 15 minutes. Thank you very much, Ben. This is going to be fun. By way of introduction, my name is Amit Mehrotra. I head up the U.S. Transportation and Maritime Shipping Research at Deutsche Bank. Maybe these guys are obviously very smart in terms of the specific demand and supply data points, and maybe it would be just helpful if I provide a little bit of a perspective on just the economics of maritime shipping and why it's so exciting, but at the same time, it's also very dangerous. And so, one thing is for certain in my view, if you own a shipping stock long enough in the secondary market, you'll probably have no money left. So that's one certainty in my view, and there are various reasons for that, but depending on what point you buy that stock at and what point you sell it, there's an opportunity for some unbelievably great disproportionate returns. And at the end of the day, what the reason for that is that maritime shipping is probably one of the most fragmented, if not the most fragmented, industries in the world. And in periods of good markets, because of that fragmentation, there's lack of supply discipline. And in periods of bad markets, translates to pretty good upside because of a negative supply response. And so depending on where you are on that curve from an investment standpoint, you potentially have an opportunity to make a significant amount of money. And unfortunately, you have a potential to lose a significant amount of money, as we've seen actually over the last couple of years. And one of the reasons for that is trying to really understand the maritime shipping company's cost structure, okay? So a piece of their cost structure is operating expenses, or what they call OPEX, and that's typically anywhere between $4,000 to $6,000 to $7,000. It's certainly gone lower during this down cycle, particularly in dry bulk. And I'm talking about dry bulk. I'll get into other subsectors in a second. The other two major components, which can actually be more than double of operating expenses, are the debt service associated with the financing of acquisitions, and also the amortization of the debt repayment. So when you sort of add all those together, it's very clear to understand that when a ship owner buys a vessel is so critical to the equity value that's generated over a cycle, or the up cycle, down cycle, or through an entire cycle. And so the problem was, in 2013, there was a significant amount of new building orders that ship owners placed with other people's money, mainly equity investors, institutional investors, and they went out and bought ships at the top of the market. And so they had break-even levels. Even though their OPEX was quite low, they had break-even levels that were astronomically high as a result of debt amortization and debt repayment terms, debt amortization and debt service. And so at the end of the day, that's what translated to a significant equity value destruction in shipping, particularly in dry bulk, not because rates went lower, but because asset values went lower, and essentially it was more of a battle on the balance sheet, and essentially we're having to raise equity at the worst period possible. So that's kind of the economics of the shipping business model. The good news is, because of the fragmentation of the market, headwinds typically turn into tailwinds, and tailwinds typically turn into headwinds. And so where we are today, we had the mother of all headwinds over the last 2 years in shipping, particularly in dry bulk, but that drove a contagion effect with respect to cost of capital, availability of capital across the industry. And as we sit here today, we are potentially at the bottom, maybe the first or second inning, maybe the second or third inning, I don't really know, of a potential asset value recovery cycle. And because of that, where we are in the cycle, someone being the most bearish on shipping equities over the last 2 years, I've turned actually towards being the most positive, arguably. And the reason for that is quite clear. It's a relatively mid to long cycle fragmented industry. Really bad markets are usually followed by really good markets. And if you look at the capital structure of most of these shipping companies, the gross asset values are in many ways multiples of the net asset value, or what we call the equity value. And so if you get relatively small changes in the gross asset value of these companies, it drives a 3 to 4x change in the equity value of these companies, which is why you've seen Starbucks' equity value on a share count adjusted basis, increased by 2,200% over the last 12 months. So I think that I agree with all my peers here. I think we're potentially on a... at the bottom of the cycle, and we're seeing some recovery in asset values, and that is extremely exciting because there's just an enormous amount of leverage to the equity value in that scenario, no matter what rates do, because in a lot of ways, debt amortization and repayment terms have been pushed out to 2019 in many cases. So the best way to play this on the dry bulk side is in my view, Star Bulk, SBLK. I think that the stock is already up a lot, like I said, but we have a blue sky scenario where that stock can hit $21 per share, and that's on the record. We've written research reports saying that, which is up from about $9 today. And that's partly based on asset values growing up, but it's also partly based on the fact that the company is still quite leveraged. It's about 80% LTV. And so at the end of the day, they have more leverage to asset values to the equity. The other piece of it is crude tankers. So this is a very fascinating sort of development, I would say, is that crude tankers obviously had a very, very strong 2015 fragmented market, albeit a little bit less so, obviously, than the dry bulk market, but nonetheless price takers. And you saw that cool off in 2016, and here we are in 2017, where I think the consensus is sort of weak first half, maybe a little bit stronger second half. And I've never really met an analyst or a shareholder that didn't think or ship owner that didn't think the market was going to be up in a year and a half from now. So, but where we are today is sort of a weaker, relatively weak market from both an asset value and rate standpoint. The thing that's different and the thing that's exciting is that the balance sheet discipline has been unbelievable in most cases. So if you look at bellwethers like Euronav, they're at 50% LTV at the bottom of the market. I mean, that's kind of unheard of in past cycles, because the old adage is you want to be actually over-levered at the bottom of the cycle on a prospective basis and then de-lever at the top of the cycle. And so these companies' balance sheets, whether it's Ardmore Shipping, Euronav, DHT, Frontline, if you look at also even Scorpio Tankers after that company cut their dividend by 92%, the balance sheets are in very, very good position. So I think that we wrote a note on Sunday, yesterday, talking about what is the next trade in shipping. And I call it a trade because, like I said, if you own shipping equities long enough, you will lose all your money. And so it is a trade at the secondary market. And I think the next two-year trade could be tankers, in which case I would own Scorpio Tankers, STNG, because, they have the most leverage. And so you have most leverage to the equity in a rising gross asset value environment. So I just think it's very important. The last thing I'll say, I think it's very important that people like to focus on rates and the most leverage to rates, but it's really important to focus on what the levers of equity value are for shipping companies. And when you sort of study the cost structure, you realize that it's really important about when the companies buy assets, because that's such a big percentage of their cost structure. And at the end of the day, that will be what drives equity value creation over time. And of course, rates and asset values are related. But when the ship owner buys assets is one of the more critical things, I think, for an investor in shipping equities. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thanks, Amit. Right. So looking to the audience, it's your turn to ask the analysts. Any questions? here we go, to the right here. Over here.
during a number of the discussions today, people have talked about whether or not there are advantages or disadvantages to consolidation. Obviously, there have been a number of large transactions in Golden Ocean, a number of other just buying ships. Could you talk a little bit about whether or not you think this is a fragmented industry? There's obviously you still need, whatever it is, 26 people on a ship. So there's not, kind of operating benefits. But Do you guys agree or disagree that consolidation would be a positive in the sense that, you know, capital, you know, how you structure the balance sheets, how you operate, you know, maybe more disciplined? It is clearly a very cyclical business, all pieces of it. But could each of you or one of you talk about whether or not you agree or disagree that consolidation could be a positive for the industry? You know, maybe take, you know, dry bulk first and then products or VLCCs. We, you know, there clearly are, you know, I mean, Golden Ocean, Frontline, I mean, things are happening out there. Why are they happening if you don't believe consolidation is a good thing?
Well, consolidation, if I can just start, if that's okay. Consolidation is used completely incorrectly in maritime shipping. I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't work because the market is too fragmented to begin with. And so benefits of consolidation are threefold in my view. One is you could potentially consolidate the market where you have some pricing power. That ain't going to happen in shipping. I guarantee you that. Maybe in certain subsegments, but generally speaking, especially in dry bulk, it's not going to happen. Second is that you can get synergies from, you know, consolidating back office things. That's, again, because I said the majority of the cost structure is the financing for the asset. So I think at the end of the day, it's a no-go from a fundamental standpoint. The only way you do have synergies, and that's valid, is in the capital markets. So if you have a big fleet, you can access debt and equity capital markets a little bit better. But it's not clear to me whether you own 70 ships or 200 ships, whether there's an incremental benefit there. There's a certain point where that diminishes. So I think it's... And then the personalities involved. I mean, no one wants to pay NAV, and no one wants to, sell for anything below NAV. So at the end of the day, that's another hurdle.
Thanks, Amit. Chris?
Yeah, I think from picking up on that point, I do think that there is some value in scale from a market cap perspective that you might get from having a larger fleet. I do think that you do shut yourself off from a certain group of investors the lower you sort of fall on that. So obviously having some scale in that respect makes sense. Amit's right. Pricing power doesn't seem particularly likely. And I think economies of scale from an operating perspective are marginal. So I don't know that necessarily brings it. You know, would we like to see sort of an oligopoly in some of these subsectors? Yeah, that would be fantastic. I don't think it's likely to happen, but my view would be more on that market cap dynamic.
Yeah, I think also if you look at take the LPG space, rather than consolidating those three, four listed names, they decided to all go to the yards and order lots of ships. I think the good thing about consolidation from the capital market perspective is actually that you create some, call it, entry barriers to go public. Now you have, you know, quite a few large listed dry bulk companies, tanker companies. So I think in a sense, the good thing about consolidation is it makes it more challenging to go public. And I think that's kind of the main thing from an operating perspective and so on. Probably not. And yeah, there's definitely challenges from the personalities. But I think that's something the listed names should think about. Is it better that we actually go together, create one big company, rather than all of us ordering too many ships as they did in the LPG space?
And every other segment.
But getting too big, though, in shipping, I get it, from an equity and debt capital market standpoint, but it could be really bad because every ship is its own mini economy. It has its own capital structure. It has its own rates. And at the end of the day, when asset values go down, all the asset values go down. And so you have to balance the chartering strategy. So the LNG could be a little bit more prone given the longer duration of those charters. But if you own 200 ships in a downturn, that's a big problem. And so sometimes there's a sweet spot where maybe getting to 50 to 70 ships gets you that critical mass where you have access to equity and debt capital markets. But getting bigger than that actually puts you at risk if you don't have a very balanced chartering profile.
If I were a ship owner, I would like to have a diversified fleet. I'd like to order to own dry bulk containers, tankers, whatever. So exactly because we have different cycles, I would like as an operator and owner to diversify my risk and counterbalance the various cycles. From your point of view, you would rather have shipping companies that are pure plays in one sector. So can I have your collective wisdom?
Well, I'll give you the answer to that. It has everything to do with greedy bankers. none of which are here. But at the end of the day, when a certain segment is hot, people want to invest in that segment. And the best way to go about doing it, and the best premiums on NAV or however else you think about it, are the pure plays. And so in the longer term, does it make sense to have a diversified fleet like AP Mueller or whoever that, you know, has balance and structure and everything else? Sure. But when something's hot, guys are being pitched all day long, do this, do this, do this, carve out a pure play, get better valuation. And at the end of the day, greed often trumps prudence.
Well, and I would maybe say it in a different way, in that while something is hot, something else might be not. And so then, you know, while one thing is working, then you have this drag. And, you know, we've seen over the cycles, over the years, you know, for the bigger companies seeking to, you know, kind of list themselves in the U.S., oftentimes investors don't want a diversified play. They want to be able to make their own and maybe even structure their own, investment basket by buying a tanker or a product tanker or a dry bulk carrier. So there's also that kind of reality. It kind of makes it difficult to work.
I agree with Doug. I think, pure plays are the best way. I think the way you should deal with your risk is actually your balance sheet. That's how you deal with risk. It's not by having some containers and some tankers. Because eventually, if you believe in something and something playing out, you want to buy the pure play.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a good currency, you know, it's not no point of really being public. So right. I think managing your balance sheet is the way to deal with risk. And
if things get too ugly from my perspective, I mean, if you look at what Robert Bugbee has done over the last 15, 20 years, whether it was, you know, at OMI or preceding companies, that's the way you kind of do it. I mean, you know, I think Amit mentioned, you know, it's important whenever you buy. It's also important, you know, if you're, you know, an owner and you don't want to ride the downturn, you know, you can identify that and get back in a different point of the cycle.
Nicholas, investors are getting smarter too. I mean, you know, prior to the downturn, it was all like, I think due diligence has improved in this downturn because people know now where the bodies are buried during a historical downturn, right? And so at the end of the day, you're talking about 2003 to 2007, it was all like, you know, the rates are going up, give me the most exposure to that. And that's what Ben is talking about, the formation of that type of industry. But during the downturn now, I think there's much more focus, at least I'm much more focused on the balance sheet, to Herman's point, and loan to values. And so you look at some companies today, like International Seaways for a minute, they own different types of assets. Their stock has done, arguably, they're the best tanker stock traded since they came out, since the spinoff.
You mean they spun off from and went to a pure play? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, they have different types of tankers. They have product tankers. They have LNG. I mean, they have FSO. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that their balance sheet has been their story, which is under 40 times LTV, under 40% LTV. 40 times. No, not 40% LTV. So I think it's the balance sheet as well.
One more question, and then we'll call today, and I'll let Nicholas close out the conference.
There's a lot of optimism about LNG stocks, and as analysts, one always writes about the risks to one's positive scenario. So this is a question to Douglas and Christian. What could go wrong with your optimistic view of LNG, whether it's trade patterns, pricing of the commodity, et cetera, et cetera?
I mean, I'll start from our perspective. I think, you know, what we've struggled with a little bit on the LNG side is, I guess, a couple of things. So fleet development is always going to be something that we worry a bit about. There's too many ships out there right now relative to the cargoes going around, and how long that persists would be, you know, would prolong a potential recovery in carrier rates. And that's something that we've, you know, done a lot of work around, and how much slack there is in the market. There are some new sort of trading patterns, and I think there's a ton mile story that is there as well that will help suck that up and soak that capacity up. But to the extent that we see, you know, the order book continue and you know, outpace liquefaction growth, and I think that certainly is probably the biggest risk that we see. Obviously economics within natural gas and extremely low prices and sort of the reduction of the arbitrage, I think all of those can potentially be risks as well. But, you know, really it's more the timing of this. I mean, we had a view a year or so ago that it was going to be more of a 2020 type of kind of recovery or balancing in the market. We pulled that forward by about 18 months over the course of the last year, and that's the reason why we've gotten a bit more constructive.
And I would say, our concerns are more on the demand side. I mean, I'm not as worried about the supply, given the visibility and whatnot, at least over the next few years. But we worry about things like another Angola that goes offline for a year or so, and then all of a sudden you have some dedicated ships that are now competing in the spot market. So some sort of like logistical kind of startup, ramp-up type of issue. We worry about some of the production trains that are scheduled to come online on time but then ultimately get pushed out. So we're always monitoring what is Chevron saying, what is so-and-so saying about, kind of how are these things progressing, Cheniere. And so those two kind of both get to like the nuts and bolts about, kind of how much LNG is there actually to ship. The big overarching thing we worry about is crude. And if crude goes back to 40 for whatever reason and Asian LNG prices go back to 5 or 6, all of a sudden it becomes very difficult to deliver LNG economically into some of those end-user markets. So crude at 45, 50, 55, it works. If we start talking about 40 or whatever, for whatever reason, maybe OPEC decides, hey, look, this whole production cut thing isn't working out, and then for a temporary period, crude comes off, then, it'll have a knock-on effect on some of the other commodities. So that's the kind of stuff that we worry about.
Terrific. Thank you, gentlemen. Really appreciate it.